Oh, can you hear me?
I can now.
Okay, I didn't realize the kids unplugged my headset
I
when
can't hear
I hit.
Chris though.
Oh no. Christopher.
Hello?
There you
Oh.
are.
For some reason the audio is coming through my.
Well, that's not our fault.
Yeah, it's probably
That's
mine because I told you
that's an operator error.
my kids unplugged my headset, so I had to plug it in. That's probably what it is, Chris.
That
Your
Chris's
kids,
kids unplugged his headset.
no, my headset. Your
Well, then
kids
why
unplugged
would
my.
that's what you're saying? That's probably what it is for him.
Doesn't make any sense.
No, unless you guys were visiting each other and watching the Buffalo Bills game together.
My prediction is only one out of three of us watched the game, and he doesn't live in Buffalo.
Yep.
That's right. I hate
I
the
went to bed at
Patriots.
nine
I was
o'clock.
there. It was
We
such a
watched the
late game.
Eternals.
And that's a
I
long
heard it was.
movie, 3 hours.
Why are they so long?
I
They're
don't
so long.
know.
Not just the Eternals. Everything's got to be 2.5 hours now, it seems.
Yeah, you can't find an hour and a half movie anymore unless you
No.
go online and stream it.
Yeah. But we both thought it was good. Definitely, we don't give it the high praise that you did. But we both thought it was good. Definitely a different type of Marvel movie, which is not a bad thing.
Yeah, I loved it. I love the
I like
themes. I
Makari.
love the themes of it.
It was very interesting, right? Because, like you had said, everyone's
It,
got
well, it's
different perspective.
very, yeah, it's just a different perspective. There's no good, there's no bad, there's just different. It's the Spock thing, the lives of the few and the lives of the many or whatever it is, you know, it's just who's bad and who's good? You can't really make that call. At least I couldn't. I know who I prefer because I'm biased because I'm on Earth, but it really doesn't make sense because that's what they were bred to do,
Yeah,
to
yes,
create
right.
universal life.
Yep.
That's no different than Galactus, really. Just they're born, they're inside of Earth rather than they travel to a new world and eat it. They
It was very interesting to me too how it lined up. Like, I don't know anything. I don't really know much about the Eternals, guys. So it's like the most famous ones are either the ones on the that had been on the Avengers at one point,
well, Icarus
for me,
and
or Icarus, because he's like the main guy. So the way that they kind of broke out the sides kind of surprised me a little bit because, some of the.
Circe is, probably the more popular than Icarus, I would say.
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. But Icarus, I think being the face of.
They had the Forgotten One too, so the what's his name? He was an Avenger.
Gilgamesh?
Yeah, Gilgamesh.
I liked him. He was
Everybody
good. He
used
was
to
good in
make
the movie. I really liked him.
fun of Gilgamesh. There weren't too many Gilgamesh fans there. I kind
No,
of
but he
like
was
that.
great in the movie, wasn't he?
Yeah,
The
yeah,
actor? He was
yeah.
fantastic.
Well, I liked all the. I thought the casting was well done. They all had like their own. Kind of, it was a big cast, but they all were featured enough. Do you know what I
Yeah,
mean?
I
To
agree.
get to know the characters, it's hard when you have such a big lineup. And how to juggle them and still get to know each and every one of them, you know?
Maybe that's why the movie was almost 3 hours long.
Yeah. I'm getting tired of the length of the movies too. It 3 hours when I was younger was a long time, but now that my life on the planet is is going away, I'd rather see more than just once. You know,
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd rather have time on a Saturday to get out of the movie and go do stuff rather than get out of the movie and oh shit, it's already time to go home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I actually offered to Stacy. I'm like, Stacy, do you want to? It was about halfway over, and it was a good ending point, good cut point. I said, do you want to turn it off, watch the rest tomorrow? Because I figured maybe she'd want to watch the football game. But she's like, no, let's watch the whole thing. I said, okay.
Yeah, it was a good
Right.
football game if you hate the Patriots. But it wasn't a good football game to watch. Like the Raider game was very close and entertaining, like from a who's gonna win. The Bills smoked them. Like they just whooped their ass from beginning all the way to the end. And I was worried at halftime because Belichick usually puts his cheat book in and figures out something, but yeah, I it it they just kept on running him over,
Crazy, huh?
which is good because the first meetup I got so mad because Belichick only passed it three times. I mean,
Yes,
I
that's
should
right,
I
that's
shouldn't
right.
I shouldn't be mad, but he was like pissing on them, like, and I kind of like that. If I was the coach, I love that, but I hate it when it's to my team. Like, if that makes any sense.
No, yeah, it does. He's a
He
pro.
manipulated them and said, "Well, if you're gonna win this game, you're gonna have to stop the run." And they literally couldn't. They couldn't. It was embarrassing. They embarrassed them. But then the next meetup, we beat them, and then we whooped their ass here. So I was happy.
Yeah.
So
Yeah, I know
one
a lot
of
of people that went to the game. It was freezing.
my other team has a bye week, so and then Barb's team plays today, so hopefully
Wait, who's your other team? Because
the
is yours team
Packers.
the Packers? I couldn't
Yeah.
remember. And so and then who's Barb's? Because I knew
No,
Packers back to.
the Chiefs.
Oh, she likes the Chiefs.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
She's
you
a
remember last year the Mike and Barb's teams played each other, which they might do again this year. All right.
It could happen, yeah.
Yeah, if they win, then they'll play each other.
Oh, they did this year. It was a lot of fun because my team won. But yeah. That's what we'll probably be doing today. I'll probably be like organizing comic books and watching football
Football,
because
yeah.
we took care of the grocery shopping and all the go to PetSmart and all that kind of stuff yesterday.
Oh, that's good.
We had a snowstorm, so Barb
Is
got
that the
to.
one we're getting tonight, or is it, I wonder if it's a different one?
It might be. I don't know how the weather pattern's moving, but
Yeah.
Barb got to try her new car in bad conditions because and it worked well, so that's good.
Oh, great. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're between tonight and then until like 4 p.m. tomorrow, we could get almost 2 feet.
Yeah, I don't like
That would
bad
be fun.
weather.
Me neither.
I don't like driving in it. I used to not mind it. Now I'm like, ever since we had that mountain accident thing, I'm always paranoid of slipping, but
Don't blame you.
put the fear in me.
The fear of God in you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to it. This will be the first like major snow of the year. We got snow a couple of weeks ago, but it was maybe 4 or 5 inches total over the course
Yeah.
of like 18 hours, so that was nothing.
I just can't believe how I'm switching topics. I was looking at Aaron Myers's, I don't know if you follow his Facebook.
I do.
I think you do 'cause you took that Adam from underneath me.
Well, you didn't want to spend all that money.
That
We just talked
showcase.
about it. You won't even get Mephisto. A
That was
couple hundred
cheap,
dollars.
man. That was cheap. But he's been putting up expensive books, man.
Very expensive books.
And to me they shouldn't be. Like Transformers number one, $150. I mean, it's like I
Yeah, I
don't
don't know what
know.
it's worth.
They were worth a lot less.
But that was a news. You know how people
No,
go
I
crazy over
just th
newsstand
this
versus
this
direct?
but this last 2 years has really killed the buying market. It's a seller's market. It's not a buyer's market. It
No, not at all.
sucks.
Yeah, it sucks if you want
It's
to buy.
frustrating because I want to complete my Silver Surfer run, and if I'd have just completed it, 4 years ago, it would have been very easy. And Mephisto hasn't even fucking appeared in anything.
But he keeps rumor every time
Yeah.
there's a show, it's rumored he's gonna be on
Jesus, man.
it. Do you have, is it number four that has that awesome cover with Thor in the Silver Surfer?
Yeah, that's another one I'm missing too.
Oh, I would love to have that just for that
I'm
beautiful
missing
cover.
like one, three, four, and one of the ones in the double digits. And then I have a
Wow,
full
that's awesome.
run. Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. So you do have to get working on this.
I think I want to finish my cap run
All
first. And I
right.
want to do the spawn. I'm real close to spawn. I only need like eight more issues.
Yeah, but I don't think Spawn's going to increase
Oh my
any
God,
more than it
yes.
already is. Do
Spawn
you?
is nuts. And they haven't even put out the movie thing yet.
I don't know. I don't see those ones that are already high priced because of their limited
They're all high priced. You can't find anything under 300 for double digits.
But that's what I mean. So I mean, are they going to get any more
And
expensive?
all those ones in the 300, there's some low print runs that are hundreds each.
I don't know. I would get all the I would get the Silver Age stuff first, but that's just me.
No, I would get the Spawn first because Spawn is my shit. Spawn and Savage Dragon. They're my stuff.
Yeah.
I know you don't like to hear it, and it makes more sense to do the cap, but to me, the 90s, they were the time that I needed comics the most to de-stress me. My anxiety level was through the roof. I was working full time. I was going to college full time, and for comics to be my escape, that I needed them, and that's why the 90s are they're way more important to me than any other decade. I used them all throughout. I read comics since the 70s continuously, but I wasn't as stressed or have as much anxiety as I did in the 90s, so
No, I mean, I totally get it from a personal point of view.
yeah.
That was the time I paid the least amount. The 90s were when I paid the least amount of time to comics, I think.
Yeah. You're missing out, man. It was an explosion of goodness.
I mean, I've since read some of the stuff. I mean, I stopped in the early 90s. I saw the beginning of it, and I've since gone back and read some of it, but it'll never mean to me what it does to you, though.
Oh,
What was
no.
your impetus for kind of moving away from it a little bit in the early 90s, Chris?
Well, it was just my age.
He was too cool.
Yeah,
Too cool for
I
school.
was too
It
cool
was
for
all it was
comics
all
for a
about the
while.
chicks. It was like, heck with these comics.
Yeah, I was interested in other stuff, and
Pheromones.
that's when I was a teenager and stuff.
Yeah. That happens, I think, for most people.
Yeah, I got
I
back.
never fell totally out. I would stop for a few months if I, like, for whatever reason. That happened twice, two or three times, but then I'd go back and pick up the issues I missed, like the two or three issues that I missed, and then just kept going.
I don't ever remember stopping. I remember buying very little, but I don't remember ever stopping. The only time I ever cut the cord was saving for the house, but Barb brought me back in. Much to her, much that she wishes she didn't.
She beats her. She's still beating herself up over that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got back into it with the first X-Men movie.
That's interesting.
I was excited about because the X-Men and Spider-Man were my favorites, so The X-Men and the first X-Men movies and the first Spider-Man movies got me like excited, and with comics again, I started catching up with what was going on outside of Marvel and stuff.
See that? Proof that a comic book movie, a superhero movie, actually drew somebody back into the comics.
Well, it drew me into too, 'cause if it wasn't for Super Friends, I wouldn't, necessarily gotten totally back in.
Back when it was still exciting that there was a comic book, like decent comic book movies. Now I don't even now I watch I don't watch hardly any of them. There's so many.
There's so many. It's what is it? It's desensitizing me. Like like one of the best movies I watched was House of Gucci. Had nothing to do with superheroes, some of the movies that I really like. Nightmare Alley. Barb was bored, but it was way too long. I'll admit it. It was one of those almost 3 hour movies, but it. I like freak shows and I like Tales from the Crypt, so it worked really well. But
You know, a lot of
I'd
that
rather go
was.
to movies that I don't know. Like I don't know the source material. You know what I mean?
A lot of Nightmare Alley was filmed here.
Yeah, I think somebody told me that. Was it you,
Yeah, them.
Rob?
I think I might have. I think after that weekend that you saw it, I might have mentioned that.
Yeah, the Marvel movies especially, I feel have gotten, they play it really safe. I feel like they've gotten pretty formulaic, so it's hard to, the plot kind of follows the same beats every time, and it can be interesting, but I sort of get bored, especially in the last like half an hour or so, because one, they're long, and by that point it's just the same like special effects bonanza at that point. It just kind of gets a little too much. We watched last one I watched was Shang-Chi, which I liked I liked that they used I like that they use Mandarin in it, and that they I liked the martial arts and stuff. But
Yeah,
even
I
with
thought that
that,
was very, very well done, a lot of those fight scenes.
yeah, like I like martial arts choreography and stuff like that, which is why I was like, I'll watch this one. But even that one, they're like, okay, we gotta figure out a way to like, it can't just be like people fighting at the end of this. We gotta figure out a way to like bring tons of special effects and stuff. Which I get, like if they didn't do that, then like most moviegoers were like be like, oh, it was boring, but it just, it doesn't super appeal to me.
I'll still go see him. I just am not as jazzed anymore.
Depends on the movie for me. By and large,
I
past
really
couple,
like I
I've
really
waited
like
for them to come on
I
Disney Plus.
really like well, Hawkeye I really liked. Like I
That was
really
great.
liked it. Haley Steinfeld or whatever. I just thought her casting was just better than the character in the comic. It was like taking the elements of her and just making it larger than life. I loved Hawkeye. I thought it was great.
I'm with you. I think that that was on par with an actual, like, I mean, obviously a lot longer because of all the episodes, but on par with an actual movie. Like, it was right up there in terms of the story and all that stuff.
Yeah, it was great. Loved it. I still have to watch Boba Fett, but I have yet to be disappointed with any Star Wars. For some reason with Star Wars, I don't get sick of it. I do take breaks because their seasons are like 23, 24 episodes of the animated show. Like I had to take a break for Rebels. Even though it's probably one of the better animated ones, so important too. Like it's in canon. Like you miss a lot if you don't watch Clone Wars and Rebels. It like tells a lot, especially in the terms of Ahsoka and some of the other things that happen. But yeah, I took a break to watch some. I like watching Amazon Prime movies because they're movies that I freaking never heard of. Like I don't even I've never seen any previews for it, and like they just show up on that while I'm scrolling, and I'm like, I just go read the caption, you know what the synopsis is, and I say, oh, that sounds interesting, and I don't watch the trailer, and I just start watching it. And one of the movies I want to talk about today, because I watched a movie that was older than 10 years, believe it or not, and it was kind of cool because you know we've talked about horror and how the invention of the cell phone has sort of gotten to the point where you can't do certain horror elements anymore, or you have to be real creative. Like one of the things they are creative with is like the dark web movies. Like I think those are very creative because it puts the element of horror on the internet. But the fact that these cell phones and coverage gets better and better with, you know, 5G, you know, they're gonna not you're gonna be able to get stuff because of the way it reflects and off of buildings and stuff like that. It gives you more coverage around the world, like even in dead spots.
Yeah, you can be like out in the Amazon,
Yeah.
rainforest and still have
Yeah, it's
coverage.
crazy. And but some of the horror movies that I watch are not really intended to be horror movies. Well, I guess they are, but they're more isolation or things that can really happen. Not horror serial killers and stuff like that, but hey, I'm in the middle of nowhere and I don't know how to survive kind of thing. Like open water. That to me, open water is freaking terrifying. If I went on a vacation and went scuba diving and learned to scuba dive and they left me in the middle of the ocean, that's like the worst horror that I could possibly deal with. But I watched one of those type of movies and it's called The Canyon.
The
And
canyon.
it is on Amazon Prime. It's from 2009. And it's that kind of horror movie except it's based on the Grand Canyon. And I've only driven through the Grand Canyon. I've never stopped. And I've
We
always thought,
visited
well,
the Grand Canyon once.
yeah. Did you take one
Yeah,
of those?
we went to Arizona for Sedona for a vacation, and we went to the Grand Canyon one day.
Did you take a mule, the
No,
mule ride?
we did not end up doing that. No,
Well,
we've
this
heard about it. We haven't done it.
one has that theme. It's a married couple that elope, and they just want to get away from the parents, I guess, because he has to accept a job with the father. And the mother's one of those angry moms because she wanted to have a big wedding, and they just said, "Oh, let's go to Vegas and let's get married, and then for our honeymoon we'll go to the Grand Canyon." But they didn't plan anything. They were like, "Oh, we'll go do a mule, one of those mule rides into the ca you know the cavern, you know, to the canyon," which is something that I consider, although. Horseback riding is, and I don't know how mules. These were pretty big mules, man. They almost looked the size of horses. They went into the canyon. Well, the one thing I didn't realize is you have to apply for a license to do this. And I don't know if it was back then, if it's still like in 2009 is still the same thing. But you have to apply for a license like in January and February if you were gonna do this type of mule ride into the canyon. And they didn't apply for it. So like the forest rangers were like, "Yo, we can't get you in. You know, you didn't do your application in time." And they went to other spots and they were like, "Oh, you didn't get your application in time." So the guy was disappointed. He goes to a bar and he's a little and he starts talking at the bar saying, "You know, I'm really bummed out. We're not going to be able to do our honeymoon like we thought we were." And the woman doesn't really care. She's like, "Well, you know, we could do all kinds of other things. This is something that you really wanted to do, but there's a lot of other things that we could do and still have a great time." But somebody overhears the conversation, and guess what? Well, he can get them into the canyon, and it's played by Will Paton, which is he's sort of like a big actor. And he's sort of like a drunk, but he knows the Grand Canyon and he's got the mules to take him in. And he gets a permit. I don't know. That's always part of a mystery. Like this drunk really didn't get a permit, but he did get the permit. And he took him in and everything's copacetic and they were supposed to go from point A to point B, but he's like, "Well, what do you want to do? You want to take the more dangerous route or do you want to just take this regular path?" And they, "Oh, let's be adventurous. Let's do this." And as he's drinking some liquor while he's on the trail, he's got the mule, and then he's got a horse carrying the supplies, you know, the water and the food and everything else. A rattlesnake just scares the horse. Well, he falls off the rattlesnake. I mean, falls off the horse, gets bitten the leg by the rattlesnake, and this is their guide. Gets bitten the leg with the rattlesnake, and then he, as he works to get the reins of the horse, he gets bit in the face. So he's like, "Oh shit." Because he even knows as a survivalist that you want to get bit usually below the heart, not above the heart, in terms of venom, the way it courses through your body. But he ends up dying, and these two are left in the middle of nowhere, and all they have is a flip phone. They get lost and they're being hunted by coyotes. And at one point, he's like, "Well, if we climb this hill," he's like, "Do you remember we went to one of those hill climbing activity places that you can just go do?" He says, "I was really good at it. Let me go do it." And they do it, and they do get a signal for like a split second. And while they're climbing, so they're on the side of a mountain, and they get the signal. They get the signal to go through, but then they fall. She falls, and then followed by him. And then he breaks his leg. His foot gets caught in a crevice. She can't get it out. She ends up having to cut his leg, his foot off. And then they're being hunted by coyotes. And then later on, towards the end of the movie, he's not doing very good, but she decides that there's a lot of coyotes. There's at least eight of them that are hunting them, you know, and they have him surrounded, and she decides to suffocate him and kill him. And guess what? The rescue helicopter shows up right after she kills him.
Course,
So.
isn't that always the
Yeah, but
way?
it was one of those crazy movies that really was low budget and didn't, the horror was, it was just being caught in the middle of nowhere with no one helping you.
Right. That's interesting. That's
Yeah.
cool. You just stumbled along that and
Yeah,
good one.
I stumble across a lot of movies more there than anywhere because they're movies that I'm like, I never heard of this. Whereas if I go through HBO Max, I've heard of all of or I've seen trailers of everything, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like sometimes I like to explore various movies.
Yeah, it sounds like a good one.
Yeah, that was one of my entries, The Canyon. Who wants to go next?
I can go. I can talk about a movie too.
Sure.
We watched. We've been watching some more older films as well. We watched Bringing Up Baby last night, which is Howard Hawks movie from 1938. It starred Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. I actually haven't seen a lot of Katharine Hepburn movies.
What about on Golden Pond?
No.
Oh, wow.
That's a good movie.
It is a very good movie.
That's one of those movies that my parents forced me to go to, and I was like, wow, that's really a good movie, but I would never go there on my own.
Same, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't... I know of, I think I've seen Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. You know, I know of, and I can't remember if I've seen, I would actually have to sit down and like watch the Philadelphia Story again or part of it to remember if, so it's like sometimes you hear of movies so many times and then time passed and you can't remember if you actually saw it or not. But
you just heard about it a bunch, yes.
Yeah. You know, but I mean, obviously she's been in a lot of, she lived to be 96 and been in a lot of films. This, obviously she was only like 29 or 30 or so. Pretty earlier in her career, she had, she'd won a Academy Award prior to this, but then had a bunch of movies that didn't do very well. And actually, Bringing Up Baby didn't do well either. It wasn't until a couple years later with The Philadelphia Story that she really kind of like recovered her reputation with moviegoer, like theater goers and stuff, theater owners. But this is what they call a screwball comedy. You know, where it's a romantic comedy, but it's even more makes fun of love a bit more. Usually like real fast-paced dialogue more like traditional comedy elements like pratfalls and stuff like that. I had seen years ago Howard Hawks, like 2 years after this, also with Cary Grant, he did His Gal Friday or His Girl Friday, which is really good, but that's also like a screwball comedy. And this one, we enjoyed it. Cary Grant plays a paleontologist, and he's working on a skeleton of a brontosaurus, and it's almost complete. He just needs one last bone, the intercostal clavicle. And he's about to be married to a woman named Alice. The other thing, like within days, their wedding is. And the other complicating thing is that there's this woman named Elizabeth Random who is considering donating $1 million to the museum. So, I mean, that's $1 million in 1938 money. So that's a lot. So the day before the wedding, he goes on, golfing with, Elizabeth's, the woman who's might donate the money, with her lawyer. And he goes to retrieve his golf ball that he kind of hooked out quite a ways. And when he gets to where his ball landed, there's a woman named Susan, Katharine Hepburn's character, and she goes, she plays his ball, you know, and so that's the beginning of their interactions. And throughout the film, she's a kind of, she's a real free spirit, very like just all over the place, kind of, you know, she doesn't care that she's not concerned whether she's playing the wrong ball, and doesn't really believe him. And then she gets in her car to leave, and he's it's his car. It's parked right next to a car that looks like her car. And she doesn't really care. She's just trying to get out of this really tight parking lot, and screws up his car. And meanwhile, he's trying to get back to his game, and things are just really going very poorly. He ends up, so he ends up later that same day, he tries to connect with this lawyer again. He goes to this really formal establishment, like coat and tails and top hat, and he runs into her again, and the frustrating incidents continue, you know. So eventually, where the title of the film comes in is that she receives a leopard named Baby. It's a tame leopard from Brazil, and she believes that her brother Mark, who is apparently over there, has sent it to her. And she mistakes, like I said, he's a paleontologist. She mistakes him for a zoologist, and so calls him. And through, you know, not any interest of his own, ends up manipulating him into helping her take this leopard baby to her farm in Connecticut. So while this is going on, she falls in love with him. And so her manipulations turn from kind of just haphazard of her own nature to intentional to keep him around. She finds out he's due to be married. And she does things like, you know, when they finally get to the farm in Connecticut, he's filthy by that point and needs, so he takes a shower, she hides his clothes, has them sent off to be cleaned while he's in the shower, and he finally gets the clavicle for the brontosaurus, and her aunt's dog, George, takes it and buries it somewhere. So they spend a while following George around and trying to get him to, you know, dig up where he buried the bone. Well, George buries a lot of stuff, and they dig up a lot of different stuff, mostly boots, looking for this clavicle. Well, as it turns out, Susan's aunt is Elizabeth Random, the one who's considering a donation to the museum. And he's already, Cary Grant's character, David, has already given quite a poor impression upon Aunt Elizabeth. And so he tells Susan, you know, don't tell her my real name. Things get further complicated when there's a nearby circus, and there the leopard in the circus apparently like bit someone, So a couple of the circus members are charged with taking this leopard away from the circus, and all at the same time when Baby has gotten free, and the two stars are out looking for Baby and trying to track Baby down, realizing as it turns out that that Baby was actually a gift for Elizabeth. They see the truck with the leopard in it from the circus, think that it's Baby, and set that one free. So now there's two leopards on the loose, one's tame and one's not. And Elizabeth has a visitor who has a history as a big game hunter, so he's out and about trying to hunt down this leopard as well. Pretty much everyone ends up at jail at some point, et cetera. So it was an amusing movie, pretty silly at times, but a lot of, like His Girl Friday, which maybe not to quite the same extent, but I still enjoy these scripts, the fast-paced dialogue and the clever repartee that they have. They used a real leopard in the film. It was a real tame leopard. In all the scenes that it was in, its trainer was just off camera with a whip. There was one incident where Hepburn twirled around, and something about the way that her dress moved or something like that, it lunged at her and had to be reprimanded. But other than that, there weren't really any incidents. But apparently Cary Grant was, whereas Katherine Hepburn was pretty comfortable around the leopard, and you could see her, clearly being filmed close up with the leopard. Anytime Cary Grant was in the script was supposed to be near the leopard, there was a stand-in or something like that, because apparently he was terrified of it, even though it was tame. And Hepburn teased him by throwing a stuffed leopard in his trailer at some point, apparently.
Hey, listen, I don't blame him. There's no such thing as a tame leopard. It's only so much, so tame.
Well, you saw that Siegfried and Roy or whatever the guy
Exactly, those are tame
mauls,
tigers.
and those were tame tigers that they've been using forever on shows. So.
He might have been the smart one there.
Exactly.
It's also, I know one other interesting sort of piece of trivia was, so when Cary Grant's character, when his clothes are hidden, the only thing that he has at that point to put on is a woman's robe, that for comedy's effect, it's very frilly. And this is how Aunt Elizabeth meets him, is in this woman's robe. And at that point, he's just out of his wits, exasperated at everything that's gone wrong in his life. And and so it's argued whether, so he says, someone asks him why he's wearing it, and he jumps in the air. He leaps in the air and says, "Because I just went gay all of a sudden." And it's debated as to whether this is the first use of gay in a to mean
Really?
homosexual.
Oh, wow.
They apparently that's not a term that really became familiar to the general public until like the late 60s, early 70s. So it's debated and will probably never be known for sure whether in what way he was using it, because it was so many years. I mean, you're talking about like 30 years before it really was like came to, you know, if you say where it is, how it is now, what people think of when you hear the word gay. But it's also documented, you know, that that was, there was, you know, more of a gay community in Hollywood and more awareness of homosexuality in Hollywood that wasn't spoken of long before it became more, you know, public. So it's interesting because it was an ad lib, which is what kind of makes it interesting. It wasn't in the script. It was something that Grant ad-libbed and was left in the movie. No one involved in the film or Grant himself suggested that that's what was meant, but yeah, it's just sort of interesting, a little trivia there. But yeah, overall we enjoyed it. Interesting, you know, that it was another film that didn't do well at the box office. It's interesting to see, you know, how many films were pre-television that were helped out in their reputation by television. Once television came around and some of these old pre-television films were put on TV, some of them, their reputation really skyrocketed, and Bringing Up Baby seems to be one of them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I've never watched that one.
Yeah, it was neat. It was, I guess I was also reading about how in the production it went way over time, and part of the problem was that Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn were cracking up laughing so often. They had trouble, like the scene where they were looking for they were digging up and trying to find the buried brontosaurus bone, took them almost all day. And so
they got along pretty well on the set, it sounds like.
It seems like, yeah. And they you know, they were both in Philadelphia Story, and I think they were in a couple other movies with each other after this, too. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, I have one that is not a movie. So I'm going to talk about Captain America 200 and some of the events that led up to it. Because at 193, Jack Kirby came back to Marvel. After being at DC for a while, this would have been in around 1976 or so. And he took over as writer and artist and editing as well, actually, although Marv Wolfman is credited pretty much almost every issue as a consulting editor. So Jack was back, and he was doing it all on Captain America for a while again, starting with 193, and he started it with this Mad Bomb saga, and basically it started off that there was this small sonic type device that went off in New York City and it caused blocks around. The people just went like crazy, like really like angry with each other, and they started fighting, and even Falcon kind of they weren't immune to it either, and they were fighting each other, and then they both kind of like with willpower just kind of overcame it, and Cap happened to notice this strange device in the alleyway, and he smashed it, and then everyone was back to normal. So basically at this point Cap's he's gotten official ID from SHIELD again after being kind of a persona non grata with SHIELD for the past several issues. He's working with them again, and they track down and figure out that there's this group that wants to kind of destroy America as we know it. and they're going to they're building or have built a bomb that's a mad bomb, rather. It doesn't actually explode, as I said. It causes people to go nuts. That's much, much, much larger than the one that affected New York City. And the rationale is that it would actually be able to encompass all of the United States, cause chaos throughout the entire country. And then this group supposedly then could kind of take over and move the country in a direction that they see fit. So over the course of the past several issues, Cap and Falcon have been investigating, trying to find the headquarters. They finally do. The headquarters no longer houses this big mad bomb, which is called Big Daddy. So they track down a professor that had been working on developing the mad bomb. Kind of, he wasn't totally innocent by any means, but he's also being heavily persuaded by this group called the New Society that's in charge of this plot. They were, heavily in persuading him to do this. He has a very sick daughter, and it was, they were helping to care for her, and it's very much implied that if he didn't keep going along with it, that his daughter would suffer. Although it's made pretty clear that he was willingly doing it as well. It's not as if they were, he was totally against it and only did it to keep his daughter alive. It was a combination of factors. So finally realizes the error in his ways, and Cap gets his daughter in a reputable hospital that to be protected and to be cared for, and he gives the whole scoop about where Big Daddy is, where these elites of the new society have moved on to. They basically want to take over the country and kind of go back to kind of how it was pre-revolution. They want everyone to know their place. They're going to be the elites, kind of like kings and queens of the country, and they'll be in charge, and people below them will have different, like almost like very high, a very like rank society, where like in like old England, where you'd have the aristocrats, and then maybe people that are a little bit more respectable underneath them than common laborers and so on and so forth. They want to go back to that. So when we pick up at issue 200, they've Cap and Falcon and Shield have realized that through the professor that the Getty bomb is in Philadelphia, and this group of elites that escaped their headquarters earlier in the story have moved on to Washington, D.C. So Cap has brought a contingent of Shield agents and the actual army to Washington, D.C. to raid this big mansion where the elites are having a gala. Now, all of this is coinciding with the actual bicentennial of the United States. So the plan is on the 4th of July in 1976, they're going to unleash Big Daddy, and it's going to be the end of the United States of America on its 200th anniversary. So Cap and his contingent are deactivating traps and so forth, getting closer and closer to this mansion where this ball is being held. Sure enough, they encounter some troops guarding the facilities. There's a big battle. They manage to defeat them. It cuts to Falcon, who is in Philadelphia, and his job is to track down the Big Daddy and to actually destroy it before they actually they set it off. So he quickly finds the skyscraper that it is being housed at. He goes in alone and knocks out the group guarding the entrance, a whole squad of army soldiers come, helicopters. They drop down. They meet up with Falcon, and they rush in. And so it's a big another big battle. They're getting ever so closer to where the actual mad bomb's being housed. We cut back to Cap, who now is actually at the actual manor house itself, and he sneaks in, dispatches a guard, and sneaks into the actual ball itself as they're giving a big speech. And they basically, you know, they see Captain America. They're like, "We've got to activate it now." So they start activating the mad bomb. We cut back to Philadelphia, and Falcon and the army are fighting off the New Society troops. Falcon, being able to fly at this point, kind of goes up above and flies into this secured room where, sure enough, this huge, probably about a 4-story tall bomb is located. And it's already being activated. They're turning it on. It's only 2 or 3 guards now in this area. It's mostly the scientists that are activating it. And the one says, you know, hold them off. The bomb will be charged in 10 seconds. So as you can imagine, Falcon doesn't have much trouble getting rid of the 2 guards. And then he starts pulling the lever that would turn it back off. And it's just, you know, very expressive in the Jack Kirby style of, you know, how hard he's pulling back to get this thing to turn off. And sure enough, right at the last second, he's able to actually get it to turn off before it activates. So we're back at the manor, and everyone's giving their toast because they know they've just activated the bomb and they think it's going to happen, where Cap, you know, as I said, reveals himself, and he starts in with a speech. And the leader, a man named Tarly, he starts complaining to Cap. He said, "Listen," he's like, there was an ancestor of a man named Steve Rogers who I've tracked down, and he's and this isn't the first time they've mentioned this, so it's not coming out of nowhere. He had done some genealogy apparently, and his ancestor had been defeated years ago by Steve Rogers' ancestor, and he's managed to track down that Steve Rogers was some weakling that wanted to get into the army back in World War II, never did, and then kind of disappeared, and nobody ever heard from him again. And you know, he's made it his mission to figure out where Steve Rogers is, so he can kind of challenge him to a duel and get his honor back. So Cap approaches him and says, "Listen, I know you've got I know you've got it in for Steve Rogers. I'm here to stand in for him for a duel." And he's got 2 pistols, and he hands one to Tarly, and he said, "Come on, let's do this. And if you're not too chicken." And Tarly points the pistol right at at Cap's chest, and basically is challenging him, saying, "You know, you don't have the guts to pull the trigger." He's like, "You know, you don't have the guts to have a duel. You have no honor. You know, what are you talking about?" And finally, the guy does chicken out, and he's like, "This is ridiculous. I'm not going to play this stupid game." And he's immediately arrested. The whole group is arrested. The army blows up the bomb, and at that point, Cap and Falcon talk to each other over walkie-talkie, find out they've both completed their missions, and the nation still stands. And so we're going to go into 201 with a new story. This one was a long one that lasted all 8 issues since Jack's been back. And you know what I noticed is that Steve Englehart was writing this for quite some time, about 30 issues before Jack came back. And it was much more Mike, we've talked about this a lot, and Chris, you as well, when we talk about a lot of the like late 70s, 80s comics and stuff. Steve Englehart was doing a lot of like the subplots where you'd have the main story and then you cut away for a couple pages with maybe what's going on with Sharon Carter, some ongoing tale there, and then cut maybe back to somebody else like Falcon and what's going on in his personal life that's not associated with Cap, and back and forth and back and forth. And I was really enjoying getting into that storytelling after, now that I've been reading this, you know, straight from Tales of Suspense, kind of getting out of the Silver Age style of storytelling and more into these subplots. And I have to say, as much as I enjoy Jack Kirby, this definitely was a step back to just like very straightforward storytelling. There was, in those 8 issues, there was literally no subplots at all. It was always focused on what Cap was doing at the time with Falcon, never cutting away to another subplot that might be going on. I had mentioned on Twitter that there was a issue a few before 200 that was involved that professor's sickly daughter. And it really almost became like kind of a love story where really Steve was falling for this young woman. And like, there's never any mention of what Sharon Carter's doing or what's going on, because they've been together now for all of these issues. She's never appeared once in these 8 issues, never even mentioned really. And I don't know if maybe Marv Wolfman as the consulting editor kind of talked to him afterwards, because that next issue where they sent the girl to the hospital to be cared for, they really, really walk it back where now like Cap is referring to her almost as if he's a fatherly figure more than a love interest. And that was not the impression at all from the issue itself. It was very much she was kind of interested in this woman. So I don't know if that kind of changed, you know.
Well, it changes months, the but, mood because you're going from one age to another and then back to another age.
Very, very much so. And again,
it's not as jarring when you inject yourself into that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, but when you're transitioning in from a Bronze Age, what I would like to say, storytelling back into a Silver Age storytelling.
And as much as I enjoyed the story, which I did a lot, those. It was a great epic story, you know, 8 issues long, but you still missed all of those ongoing subplots, like carrying your, you know, the story over from one issue to the other with going on.
I'm reading Machine Man, and it's the same way. In other words, you see a perspective from the villain, and you see a perspective from the hero, but you don't have any subplots.
Yeah,
It's just going from point A to point B.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Mike. That's exactly it. Yeah. But, you know,
it usually goes there pretty fast, which is interesting. It's not decompressed, you know.
Not at all. No.
There's a lot that happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was my first offering.
Yeah, it's interesting. You got to see that in context.
Yeah.
All right. Well, mine. Like I was telling Rob, I've been going to that box near the couch that still has a lot of my comic shop stuff that I have inventoried, but I haven't read. And this is Flash number 242. This is kind of when I got into Flash around the 25, 20 cent era. This is 30 cent, but I remember it having Flash and Green Lantern in it when I was picking it up off the spinner rack. And this was a really good series. Like, I hate when I'm reading these books out of context and I can't go find, like, this one might be an easier one to find, but I have to lift long boxes. They're not in drawer boxes, so I can't just pull it out. I have to move stuff, and it's not easy to move in the basement anymore because everything's stacked and there's really no floor space to move it to, so it becomes really challenging. But The Flash, during this time was written by Kerry Bates, which he's one of my like go-to Superman Flash writers. I like it really clicks with me. I like his storytelling as well. But it is sort of in the storytelling that Rob was talking about where Jack, you know, there's not a lot of subplots. Although there were two subplots in here. Flash is going to a bank and there's these people that are like frozen, like they're being held up and he can't see anybody there. Well, there's these electric beings in there that are robbing the bank and they're formed of electricity. And he can't really do much about them, but he ends up fighting them and taking the money back as they escape. And then he returns the money, and the policeman tells him, you know, he goes, you fared better against the electric gang today than you did last time. And he's like, what do you mean last time? What are you talking about? This is the first time I took him on. So there's something weird going on at this time where Flash is like losing his memory. Like he's got something going on where he can't remember things very well. The colorist kind of messes up with Iris's hair, but hair color. But her and Barry are married, and she's a reporter, and she's trying to uncover who this electric gang is. But Barry's sort of like losing his mind, and he sees her take off in a taxi, and he's like, where the hell's she going in that cab? She said she was going back to work, but she's not going back to work. I think I'm going to turn to the Flash and vibrate at a high frequency so she can't see who I am and see where she's going. So he's going to go spy on his wife, which I think is very interesting. Meanwhile, there's a weird cloud forming over Central City, and it's the Weather Wizard, and you're like, well, what is he part of this plot? What's going on? And the same thing happens to Boomerang. He's got a flying boomerang, and he's flying overhead. And there's this Ace Floor Cleaning, and they're going to a stamp place, and they go to rob the stamp place. I guess back then there were stamp stores, which I find interesting, like to sell collectible stamps. I remember the green stamp stores, which were these were stores where you would collect green stamps from the grocery store, and then you'd fill in a booklet, and then you'd go to a green stamp store. And then if you had enough green stamps, you could get a blender or you could get a toaster or, you know, things like that. But I don't remember stamp stores just selling like a comic store collectible stamps. But these cleaners are gonna go rob it. They're the electric gang. And what their thing is they go in as a cleaning company, they scout it the day before, figure out how they're gonna rob it, and then use this technology that they have to turn into these electric beings and go rob whatever they're gonna rob. Well, Flash is there with Iris. He's still spying on her, and he's like, "Why did she go to the medical center? Is something wrong? Is she pregnant? Are we having a baby?" I'm like, "Oh, that's interesting." He doesn't even know why is she at the medical facility. So Flash takes these the electric gang on and takes them out, but it was really Iris that helped enough in order for him to win. She gave him the clue that she needed to take out the electric gang. And he asks about the group, and she goes, "I've been following this gang for a long time. You should know about this." And he's like, "I don't remember anything." And she talks about going to the doctor, about trying to do research. She was trying to figure out how to take out the electric gang, and she said, "I told you this." And he's like, "What are you talking about? I don't know what the hell's going on." So he's losing his mind. He doesn't remember anything. And meanwhile, the rogues are getting together to mourn one of their dead members. And I don't know who it is. Is it the top? Because who's there? Captain Boomerang, Captain Cold, Heat Wave, Weather Wizard, Mirror Master, and Trickster. So it's not one of them. Who is it? Who's the dead rogue that they're coming to mourn? I don't know. Golden Glider, but I think she was way after this. She was like in the 60 cent, and that's Captain Cold's sister. I don't know who the extra rogue is. Because Abracadabra was never a rogue, was he? He'd go in his own stuff.
You know what? I'm trying to remember at the time. I know that the top
The top did die, so it could be him.
Oh.
But it's odd that they're I'd have to go look at covers to see when he was taking on the top.
Yeah.
Because the top was a rogue. And then it has a backup feature. This has some interesting ads. It has those collector's editions, treasury size. It's got the Secret Origins of Supervillains treasury edition and the a Batman treasury edition. I think I have one of these. I'd have to go look. I think I have the Supervillains one. But the interesting things about these is I don't remember seeing these in stores, and I used to have to cut the coupon out to order them. But it's amazing the cost. It was relatively cheap because it was like $1.50 for a treasury edition,
yeah.
And that included postage and handling. The good old days.
I was just gonna say
where
that.
You could spend 50 cents on shipping and handling. You don't have to spend $14 to get something there, but
God.
And then there the second story was a Green Lantern story, but at this time it seems like Green Lantern was fighting the Ravagers, and they're an alien race that were coming towards Earth, and he has his little. He has that little starfish that he keeps on his shoulder, Izzy. And he takes on this one that gets launched, and the only interesting thing is on when he gets to Earth, this Ravager uses a ray type technology which inverts sizes, which is very weird. Like, if you had a tiger, well, now the tiger is like an ant, but the flea that might be on the tiger is a giant-sized kaiju. So it's like, what the heck is going on? He finds a way to invert it. It doesn't make sense, but it involves dust. I guess if you collect enough dust and you drop it on there, you can revert the... he uses winds, dust, and he creates a storm out of his ring like Storm would. He creates thunderstorm like Thor, which I never knew Green Lantern could do that, but I guess you can. And he does. What was the other interesting thing in here? Is the first one was written by Kerry Bates. And the writer was, the artist was Irv Novak with Frank McLaughlin. Very, very nice. The next one was Dennis O'Neill and Mike Grell. So you had some really big names on the backup feature. But
it's interesting that it didn't occur to me until you were talking about this because. Like, I knew that, like, Green Lantern had some backups in Flash during this time. But then I was just thinking to myself, why did he have backups? He's had his own comic since, like, 1960.
But there wasn't being published at the time.
Yeah, it was just looking. Yeah. There's like, a four-year gap.
Yeah.
4.5-year gap.
And that's when he was in there, yeah.
Wow. I had no idea he had that long of a gap without a title.
Yeah, it was very, very interesting. There was a couple of other neat things in here. It had an ad to retire, like early. If you wanted to retire by 50, you could go join this business selling stuff. And it has like a, I don't know what you're selling, but he's driving a van of some sort. But it says, when I plan to retire before 50, this is the business model that made it possible. That's interesting to
Yeah.
have in a comic book, especially because at this time I would think comic books were more for the younger age, and that's got a retirement ad in there. And then it's got a thing with jewelry saying, imagine making up to $100 in a single hour operating a business you can carry in your pocket. It's basically selling some kind of jewelry. And
Really weird ads. Yeah. I was reading in some of those caps and stuff. It was the same thing. A lot of those, like, to go to school for, like, to be a land surveyor and, like, all these, like, I don't know. It's just obviously geared towards adults, you know?
yeah.
Like,
Well, maybe it was trying to get kids in to think they could do something at a very early age. I don't
could
know.
be too, yeah.
The
Interesting.
subscription page is interesting because as I go through this, it makes me realize, well, this was what, 19. I gotta look up what year this was. 1976. And I have almost every DC comic from 1973 proper, but this just makes me realize how much I'm missing of, 'cause they were very diverse. They were a diverse line, I tell you, at this time. They had a lot of war, a lot of horror, comedy comics like Plop, Claw the Unconquered, fantasy comics. They had Tarzan, Kung Fu Fighter, Black Hawk, GI Combat, The Unexpected. It's very interesting what was being published here, and how much I think I don't have, because I don't have a lot of the horror line that was being published, and I know I don't have Plop. Even though I know my brother used to collect Plop, I don't know where those ended up. I know I
Yeah, I
don't
think I've
have
got
them.
one issue of Blob.
Yeah, it was like Mad Magazine in comic format, but gross kind of thing. It was weird. The covers of Plop are pretty nasty, gross looking.
Yeah, they're very strange.
Yeah, it was a very cool read, and a lot of people praising Kerry Bates' style of writing, because
I
I
was looking
guess
at
he
that too,
changed
Mike, and
the
he had a
writing
hand in
styles.
writing. He wrote, at least co-wrote, every issue from 218 all the way until ended at 350.
Yep, he wrote
Yeah.
it way up there. And
It's
that's how
crazy.
he was the writer that got me into Flash for sure. And then later on I read a lot of Kerry Bates's Superman in Action comics. So I really like Kerry Bates. It's
Yeah.
one of my favorites.
That's cool.
Yep. All right, Chris, you're up.
All right. So I read Vampire Tales number one.
Is that a
Oh, did you read
magazine?
Vampire Tales?
That's a Marvel
Yeah.
magazine, I
Yeah, it was a
think.
Marvel magazine. They collected these like a little while back, and for some reason they just got added to Hoopla. I don't know why, but well, maybe because of the forthcoming Morbius movie. But
That's cool, though.
yeah, one complaint I have, most of what I have to say is positive. One complaint I have to say is Marvel really like phoned it in with the covers of these trades. Like for this, for all of them, I think they did at least three volumes of it, and for all of them, it's just like a gray background, and then they like cut out a black and white image. In this case, it's Morbius, and they just took like the splash page from the first story. It's Pablo Marcos art, and just copied like and pasted it basically like on a gray background.
Wow,
And
that's too. I mean, I'm looking at the covers of the actual magazines, and they're incredible.
Right, that's my point. Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's just they really cheaped out, and the actual covers of the magazine, which are in there in between the issues, they could have just like reproduced one of those.
Right,
it would have been like way nicer. So
the only strategy I could think of is they wanted to make it clear that what they were going to see was not color.
Yeah, maybe, but
because the covers, if they use the original covers, you might think, well, why isn't it color? Because the covers are gorgeous. I mean, all the magazine covers are gorgeous. Yeah. They did way more realistic covers for magazines than they did for comic books themselves. Because they were trying to appease an older audience with the magazines. Oh, you know, kids read comics, but adults will read the magazines.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they just, like, cheaped out. But the contents are good. The magazine was edited by Roy Thomas. Not every story in here is credited. It's interesting. They list a bunch of staff members: Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Don McGregor, Tony Isabella, Murray Friedman. So whatever they did, I mean, they contribute some stuff to subsequent issues, but the writers that they credit for this issue are Chris Claremont, Mark Evanier, Gardner Fox, Steve Gerber, Ron Goulart, and Roy Thomas. And then artists, they credit Burnett, Bill Everett, Pablo Marcos, Winslow Mortimer, or Win Mortimer, and Paul Reinman. The spiritual consultant, the late Reverend Montague Summers, appointment by seance only. it's copyright 1973. It's interesting, like, they kind of have, like, the horror host introduction type of thing, but they, like, took just, like, a still image from movies. So it's like a photograph from a movie, a black and white movie. And so it starts with, like, Orlok from Nosferatu. That has, like, word bubbles pasted onto, like, the photograph. The first story is credited, Steve Gerber and Pablo Marcos, and this is where that cover image comes from, and it's just called Morbius. And at this point, he's appeared in other, like, Spider-Man and other Marvel comics, but this is like a feature on him, an ongoing feature. So it ends on a cliffhanger, but it takes place, he's gone out to Los Angeles, fleeing some of the difficulty that he's had, like, in New York City and stuff. And it starts with him hungry and needing to feed, so he kills a young woman, and then, you know, has this sort of self reprehension. There's a little bit of a recap of how he was a scientist and was trying to cure himself, for new readers, and some of the, like, tragedy that's occurred in his life, and how he's there looking for help, but also seeking out the love of his life, Martine. He finds some different clothes to wear. Like, there's just, like, a box, like a Goodwill box, in an alleyway. And this is, like, you know, like, still seems kind of like hippie West Coast. He's on the Sunset Strip, and he meets this woman who has, like, stuffed, these symbols look like it's like a cross with a circle around it painted on her cheeks. And, she tells him it's the emblem of the children of Satan. you know, she's kind of interested in his look, and she finds out he's looking for someone, and so she tells him she knows a crystal gazer that she can take him to. And Morbius is expecting, you know, like he says, an old hag with a ball of glass, and that he's a scientist and stuff. And so it's that one thing that's kind of interesting about Mobius as a character is that, you know, he's a vampire technically, but also a scientist. It's sort of a tension there. But so she takes him to this Madame Lara, and she's not at all like he was expecting. She's like a young woman, also has those symbols painted on her cheeks, and so she does her seance, and he sees an image of Martine with like a knife stabbed in her chest, and he gets angry. Morbius gets angry and breaks the crystal glass, and this like demon comes and forms out of it, calls itself Nilrak. So they fight, and over a few pages, and by the time Morbius overcomes him, he hungers again and tries to feed on the demon, but it doesn't have any blood, and so he ends up feeding and killing off of the fortune teller woman. So again, he's upset about what he's done, and this other girl that he's met, Carolyn, she's for whatever reason she's not afraid of him and takes him back to her place, but you know, because she, I guess, her interest in the occult and stuff, she still finds him interesting. And but he doesn't want to risk her life by staying there. She's like, so he decides to leave, and she's like, well, why don't you just let yourself run wild, murder people? But he's obviously more morally complex than that, so it just kind of leaves with ends with him leaving. They have like a text throughout. They have like these text pieces. This first one is more of just like a introduction of the first issue and how it came together. Then there's a story called To Kill a Werewolf, which is only credited on the art to Bill Everett. And this is about this asshole named Kenneth Long, who as a boy, his like activity is to like torture and like hunt dogs. So he's off in the woods trying to hunt dogs, and it's more of like a wolf jumps out, bites him on the arm, and his arm starts turning into like a dog or wolf paw. The doctor amputates his arm to stop it from spreading. And then, you know, years go by, and he's an older man, and he still hates dogs and is still like hunting dogs. He hires a man to like assist him, and he's got lots of money now, so he's got traps and rifles and poison and stuff like that, all dedicated to killing dogs. And as expected, like the amputation didn't do any good, and he turns into a wolf himself, and he's, you know, talking about how it's spreading and everything, but his voice turns into a howl, and the man that he hires hears him howling and thinks, well, there's a dog in there with his employer. The man tries to, even in wolf form, he tries to write a note telling him, like, I don't want you to kill dogs anymore. But the man just takes it as like a trick and kills the guy, as he deserved. And he turns back when he's killed. So then there's an article by Chris Claremont, or like the first part of what's going to be a multi-part article, I guess, about vampires and their origin and like going back to, this is where that Montague Summers reference comes in, which apparently like he was a priest and he did like, he published a bunch of books and one of them was like a book on vampires, which he claimed to be real. And then we have a picture of Christopher Lee as a vampire, with a bunch of word bubbles introducing the next story. And this one is called The Vampire with a Y. And it was kind of interesting to read.
I wonder how they did that. Is that a real picture of Christopher Lee introducing?
Yeah, it's like a...
How do they get like the rights for that? Like,
I don't know.
It has to be like from the Hammer movies, right?
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like...
No, I agree with you. Yeah.
Like, how would Marvel be able to take this image of some studio unless they were part of the... I don't know. It just seems odd.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. He says, I am Dracula. No, dear friend, I've not wandered by error into the wrong publication, though I know my own magazine, Dracula Lives, yet stalks the newsstands of this fair land. So maybe they had a deal with this likeness at the time for the other magazine or something.
Well, I know, like, I read a lot of, like, Tales of the Zombie, and they would do a lot of film stuff, like showing, like, a film, but they were articles, so I could see how they could get rid of an article, but this is, like... him as the Crypt Keeper introducing the next story. it's just weird.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it was a loophole because it was a magazine.
Maybe.
That's interesting.
Is there a copyright along the side that says copyright Hammer or?
Nope. Nothing.
That's weird. Yeah.
Yeah. So this next story called The Vampire with a Y was kind of interesting to learn about because it's an adaptation of a story by John Polidori, which apparently it was originally like misattributed to Lord Byron. Because it came out of like the same meeting of like Lord Byron and Mary Shelley that resulted in Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein. And Lord Byron had like an unfinished story that dealt with vampires. And John Polidori was also like at that same meeting and like, was inspired by that and created this story, which predates Dracula and stuff. This is the one. So this was scripted by Roy Thomas, and it has art by Wynn Mortimer, who's like in the later part of his career at this point. You know, he was like known at DC for doing Superman for a while and other stuff. And I really like the art in here. It's I don't know if it's like inked very much, but if it is, it's lightly done. It's got like a real pencil-y feel, and it's really nice. I like it. It really goes well with the black and white, I thought. But it takes place in London in the 19th century, and it's about this guy named Lord Ruthven, who turns out to be the vampire. And it's just kind of about how the narrator meets him and decides to go on a trip to him with him to Greece by way of Paris. And it's interesting because it's slightly different than than the vampire that we've come to know. He still, you know, drinks blood, and it seems like he has to specifically feed upon young women. He gets seemingly killed, but then he tells the narrator to leave his body out there exposed to the rays of the moon. So, and he doesn't have any like problem with sunlight or anything like that, but he says, you know, he prefers the rays of the moon, and he asks for his body, which should be dying, to be left. And he makes the narrator swear that he won't say anything of his death when he returns to England. And so he leaves him there dying, and he gets back to London, and Lord Ruthven is there and seemingly completely healthy. And he's like, remember your vow. And so technically you can't say anything of the person's death based on the vow, but he didn't think he was going to be like hiding the fact that someone that's still alive, died. And so it seems that he like regenerates from the moonlight or something like that, a little bit different than, we're used to, but, it's just a couple more short stories. There's one called Satan Can Wait, and it's about this guy who doesn't believe in like the devil, and he so this stranger comes into the bar where him and his friends are talking about like deals with the devil and stuff, and the stranger says, well, if you don't believe in it, then why don't you sign this contract I just wrote up that you'll sell your soul for $1 million. And prior to this, they're talking in their conversation about only like a murderer could be said to have sold his soul to the devil, because they take a life. So he goes ahead and does that, and because he doesn't believe in it. And the same night when he comes home, he finds out that his father's died and left him his factory, and it's worth like $250,000. And he's like, he does think of the pact, but he's like, oh, what am I thinking? Like, I'm getting as bad as my friends. And so time passes, and his life, which used to be pretty carefree, he didn't have a lot of money, but didn't have a lot of responsibility, and he just enjoyed most of the world, meeting up with his friends and chatting. And now he's got tons of stress, and his workers hate him. And it gets to the point where he's worth exactly $1 million, and he remembers the pact. And a man appears at his door, and it's that guy who he signed the paper with, of course. And he says, he actually brings him the paper he signed. He said, hey, it was just a gag. You know, I thought it was funny that I heard about your big factory, and I just lost my job. So I thought maybe you could give me a job. And I just brought this paper along because it was just a gag. And at this point, the man's life is so miserable that he hits the guy. He's just so offended by the fact that he would call it a gag, this bit that ruined his life, basically. He takes like a candlestick and bashes him over the head and kills him.
Nice thing to do.
No, not really. I wouldn't recommend it. And it ties back to, you know, now he's a murderer, and murderers are the ones that would sell their souls. So he just walks off into the raging night, into the forest. And then there's this article by Mark Evanier about the worst, no kidding, vampire films ever made. That was part of the title. I didn't add no kidding in there. And they do have pictures in here from movies, Blood of Dracula, The Vampire Goes West, Plan 9 from Outer Space, Adam Age Vampire, which they call the biggest bomb since Hiroshima. That's
boy.
A little insensitive kind of there, Mr. Avenir. And Curse of the Undead. And then finally, there's a story by Gardner Fox and Burnett, the artist, just Burnett, called The Revenge of the Unliving. And this is about a female vampire who comebacks. Well, I don't know if she died, but she comes out of her coffin, and it was someone named James Gordon who tied her up and left her in the coffin. But she doesn't die, so she comes back. She finally gets out, and she's seeing cars for the first time and trying to figure out how long have I been gone. And she flashes back, and we see the circumstances. Seems to be about like 80 years ago, and this James Gordon, he wants to end things with her. He's going to be married, and must have had something going on with this woman named Melissa, who's the vampire. She reveals herself to be a vampire when he says he wants to break things off with her. And this is where he does actually manage to overcome her and puts her in this coffin and covers it up with cement and closes the house off. So that's where she came to be in her circumstances. And she runs into a woman, and she's surprised at how short her skirt is and how thin the cloth is. But she kills her and takes her clothes so she can fit in. And she tries to hunt down this Jim Gordon, but she's realizing so much time has passed, he's probably not around anymore. Well, she finds her, his grandson, who's like the same age James Gordon had been at that time, and is also named James, and she's going to get her revenge on him. And she hasn't even tried to, and no subterfuge or trying to like trick him or anything. She just says straight out what she's going to do, and attacks him. And they're fighting on a rooftop because he was like up there trying to fix the antenna and stuff. And he's about to lose his footing. And there's like a storm starting, and there's lightning, and he sees like a skeleton in ragged clothing and like adjusting the, like taking like the antenna off of it. And while the young Jim and the vampire woman are fighting, he sees this skeleton throw the antenna down and pierce her in the back, and she turns to ashes, and he's left wondering if he really saw someone on the roof or not. And I forgot to mention that when his grandfather first put her in the coffin, he declared that if she ever found a way to escape, that he would be sure to stop her. So implication being that, he came back to life to kill her. So. But yeah, it was neat. It's cool like that we get to see these magazines, that they did at the time, just a different format and a different audience, and the black and white art, and just the Marvel of the 70s was definitely a very different Marvel to the one today. And this first volume has the first three issues, it's like 200 page trade, because one issue is like over 60 pages. And interesting, just looking ahead at the table of contents, you have like stuff written by Don McGregor. Next issue has a Satana story by Roy Thomas and John Romita. There's some Jim Steranko, Rich Buckler, more Don McGregor, Tony Isabella. Issue 3 has a story by Stan Lee and Carmine Infantino, Klaus Janson. So it's just, a lot of It wasn't, you know, just something they tossed off on the guys trying to get their start or something, you know?
Yeah, I've never read any of those. I only knew that they exist just recently when reading my Captain Americas I've been reading. I've seen some ads for those magazines. But otherwise, I don't think I would have ever even known, like, prior to 6 months ago that they even existed. I'd love to get my hands on a couple to read.
Yeah, I knew, like, the other, like, the Tomb of Dracula and, like, other stuff, and I knew that they had done some magazines. I knew some of those, like, Conan and stuff.
Yeah, like Conan, yeah.
I didn't know that they did this one, which it, maybe because it didn't seem to have lasted as long, but it's, yeah, it's neat.
That's really cool. I guess it's my turn, huh? Last
one? It is.
Yep. All right. Okay, so the other one I just picked up at random, just some JLAs that I haven't read yet that I picked up over the past couple of years and haven't gotten to. So this one is Justice League of America number 131 from 1976. Jerry Conway is the writer, and Dick Dillon and Frank McLaughlin are the artists. Unbeknownst to me, this drops you off. It looks like at least in the second part of a trilogy, if not even maybe it's further into a longer story, but it's definitely not the first part, and when I got to the end, it's not the last part either. So I haven't read the beginning or the end of this, just read the middle. So it's actually cool. This is you know, in the early satellite days. We got the little roll call, actually both on the cover and also on the first page. So this issue, we've got Superman, Flash, Atom, Elongated Man, Aquaman, and Hawkman. And they get you up to speed on the first page, letting everyone know that there was some sort of a plague that struck the United States that was associated with money. Apparently, this was attached to money. So as people spent and shared money, they would get they would end up getting this weird physical strength, higher physical strength, and go nuts and stuff like that. I'm not clear as to like if it was fatal or if it was temporary or whatever. But anyhow, that's what it was. So. At the beginning, Superman and Flash are encountering the last pockets of this this disease that's going around, and they manage to get these people to a hospital, and they find that it's Star Laboratories. They've developed a special credit card to use that. Actually needs to be used now to replace standard money, and everyone would have one. It can only be used by the rightful owner. It actually has the owner's fingerprint on it and a special sonic code. So they talk a lot about stuff that we take for granted right now, like the one gentleman is saying, you know, I suppose that the national computer system would keep track of the money supply. And the inventor says, exactly, on payroll day, a man would receive a direct deposit to his credit account. Can you even imagine such a thing? So, you know, they're very excited about this. They can take money out of circulation and get this disease wiped out. And, so they congratulate the inventor and says that he's going to get a special presidential commendation for this, provided it does its job. And the inventor says, "Oh, well, Mr. Secretary." And then he thinks to himself, "Beyond your wildest dreams. So what could that mean?" We cut to Elongated Man and Atom, who have decided to enjoy a peaceful afternoon at the Ivytown Zoo. And unfortunately, they're with their significant others. And unfortunately, it's neither quiet nor peaceful because, in mass, all of these animals break out, and somehow they open their special combination locks on their cages. So they're not sure what's going on, but Elongated Man quickly stretches out of his regular civilian clothes and goes into action. And Ray runs over to the side where nobody can see him, and he changes into the Atom. And they do the best that they can, being that, you know, one stretches, the other just can shrink, and that's kind of rough with tigers and lions and stuff attacking. They don't have a lot of ways to necessarily stop them. Elongated Man has a one lion all wrapped up, so it can't move, but now he's kind of stuck. And so Ray's doing his best, like pulling this tiger by his tail, and he's being bounced around a lot, actually, and Elongated Man ends up having to catch him up in the air when Tiger swats at him for pulling his tail. All these other zoo-goers are now surrounded by a variety of animals, apes, tigers, lions, elephants. Elongated Man doesn't quite know what's going on, but he ends up grabbing a fire extinguisher and starts spraying the animals, and the foam is doing the trick because they can't stand either the cold or the smell. And using the fire extinguishers, they drive them back into one cage and they lock the cage. So you got all these animals stuck in the same cage. But they also noticed that the animals were acting smarter, but also the people were acting dumber. They were like kind of like standing, like they couldn't figure out. People couldn't figure out how to escape. They were kind of standing around, petrified, letting the animals surround them when they had opportunities to get away. So not quite sure what's going on. But they go ahead and they send an alert to the Justice League to meet up to try to figure out what's going on. So we cut to Chapter 2 with Aquaman underwater, and he sees a sub with a bathysphere actually doing some surveilling. When a giant squid grabs the entire sub and starts crushing it, Aquaman tries to control the giant squid and gets feedback, basically showing that the squid has this mental power of its own to resist him, and actually gives him like quite a headache. It gives the squid the opportunity to grab Aquaman. Aquaman does call all these stingrays, I guess. Now, I don't know. School of Torpedo, electric rays. I don't know if those are real things. But electric, they're basically stingrays, but he's saying they're electric. So they cover the sub, and they start electrifying the metal sub, which makes the squid let go. Aquaman explains, as he's thinking, that these are usually heavily insulated, so the men inside should be fine. They get topside. He opens the hatch to make sure everyone's okay. And the man just has like a panic look on his face. They're not saying anything. He's just going, "Ooh!" And he punches Aquaman right in the face, unexpected. So, again, the people are acting very, very strange. We meet up now in the headquarters of the Justice League, and Hawkman was on satellite duty, and Flash comes in through the teleporter, and Adam and Elongated Man are explaining what they've encountered to Superman, Hawkman, and Aquaman shows up, and he's in pretty bad shape because a bunch of civilians took him by surprise, kept beating him. And he's like, "They weren't criminals." He's like, "I actually just rescued them, and I was too stunned to fight back." So they're not sure what's going on. Before they get any more information, really, they get a direct alert from the Pentagon, and it's it's a high-ranking general saying that there's been some sort of weird plague of a poison in the air which slows human beings' brains. And the army is falling apart. They're just acting like dumb beasts. And even worse, a giant beast storm is approaching New York City. So you see this huge swarm of bees coming towards New York City. It actually envelops Air Force, a couple Air Force jets, and they get in everywhere. You also see the Bee Queen flying around with the bees. Superman, Hawkman, Flash, and Aquaman make it to New York City to rescue these jets, and the bees are again acting in a very intelligent manner. They see the Bee Queen and figure that she's directing them what to do. The Man of Steel goes ahead and takes off his cape and captures a whole bunch of the bees in his cape. And he's like, okay, well, I've got these. I'm not sure what to do with them. I don't want to kill them. More bees start swarming him. Now, obviously, they can't hurt him because he's invulnerable, but one ends up flying into his ear and starts buzzing away like crazy, making it very distracting and really stunning him because he's obviously got super hearing as well. So they continue to figure out what's going on. Hawkman and Aquaman are nearby, and suddenly what looks to be a man comes flying up into the air and his head hits Aquaman right in the stomach. But and Flash rescues Aquaman, but Hawkman goes after this man, but he notices it's not a man, it's a mannequin. And as soon as he hits the mannequin's head off, all these bees come flying out, and they notice Queen Bee again, and like, ah, she's controlling these bees with her wand. And so Hawkman grabs Bee Queen, and she's kind of in a stunned state as well. And she's like, I have no idea what's going on. It's not me. I'm a victim as much as you. So she's really her wits are not about her either. And now Hawkman's starting to feel a little groggy. They start noticing that they're all not feeling quite right, and think that maybe they're starting to dumb themselves down as well. And Bee Queen somehow knows that. All of this is happening because of the Sonic credit cards that was substituted for paper money. And the Sonic pattern is creating a brain power funnel between humans and beasts and transferring intelligence, not knowledge or memories, but intelligence from humans to animals. So, here it does explain how she knows a little bit more and how she wasn't she wasn't affected because she's an alien, but she was under the bee's control rather than vice versa. So Flash has an idea, and he starts vibrating his body at super speed to try to counter the sonic pattern of these credit cards. He says he wishes he could think more clearly, but he's got to give it the best that he can. And so he twirls and twirls and twirls as fast as he can. The bees start scattering with confusion, and he is having harder and harder to think. Finally, he can't stand up anymore, and he falls down and just to the ground and says, I failed. And the next scene, you see Flash, Aquaman, and Hawkman all being covered by bees that are all flying back. And there's a quick epilogue in Star Labs in Metropolis, and Elongated Man and Atom are there, and they're talking to the inventor of the credit cards and Ray Palmer is saying that he suspects the credit cards are deadly dangers to everyone, and we must check your computer program. And the inventor says, oh, as you wish, please step inside. And he goes on to think, and while you do, say your prayers, for you'll never come out alive. And so the next issue concludes this adventure, and apparently we find out more, including who this inventor is. As I said, I went in this cold, so I have no idea where this goes or who this inventor is, although he does look quite a bit like Tio Maro. So I wonder, but I mean, I would imagine that the JLA would recognize him if that's who it was. But this was a good one. Even though I just went in, you know, without knowing where this was coming from or where it's going, it was still a fun issue to read.
Yeah, those comics are good to read, but sometimes they get you into it where you want to go before and after, and you're like, oh,
Yes.
I don't want to go look at that long box. And we're in an era where those aren't necessarily on the app.
Yeah,
So.
and Mike, like that was one of the first series that I'm like, oh, I want to try to collect and get a bunch of them. So I still don't have them all, but like I have like pockets of issues. So like one, this is what issue was it? 131. So like I probably owned 130 and 132 for years and years and years, or just been put away for literally decades. You know what I mean? And I finally got this 131 a couple of years ago, and now I'm reading it literally probably 20, 30 years after I bought those other two and probably read them a long, long time ago. So yeah, I mean, I could go back and grab them, but I mean, it doesn't make a difference. It was just fun to read this regardless.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I think we can wrap this episode up.
Yeah, I don't have anything else. It's just I, you know what, the only thing I wanted to mention quickly, I'm not going to cover it, but I got that Hammer film collection. We were talking about Hammer before. I got that film collection for Christmas, and at first I thought it was going to be just like all the Hammer horror movies, and that's what a lot of the first ones are. But like it goes on to like a pirate adventure movie that I haven't watched these yet, but a pirate movie, like a Robin Hood movie. It's got a lot of different genres.
Is
And
this on
there's
an
one.
Amazon or something? The Hammer collection?
I bought the collection on. Well, I didn't buy it. I got it for Christmas. Whoever bought it for me, I think Stacy did. I assume she got it from Amazon. It's got quite a few movies on it.
But how many is it? Is it this
Hang
Hammer
on, I'm going
Films
to
Ultimate
pull up.
Collection?
Huh?
Hammer
What'd you say?
Films Ultimate Collection?
That's the one. That's the one. Yes.
Okay.
So it's got a lot of movies on there. I don't
I'm
know.
surprised, like I've always been like not wanting
20 movies.
to go see the Hammer films. Like
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I've always been like, oh, I'm a Bela Lugosi guy. Who's this other
See, I, me
Christopher Lee
too.
guy? Let the British go do their thing, and I'll stick to my Bela Lugosi Universal. But as I watch I've seen like a handful of Hammer films. They're really good, and
Yeah.
some are like crazy nuts. I mean, I
Yeah,
sort
it's a
of
different
dig.
era. It's
I
a different era
do.
than the Universal.
So.
Mike, I'm like you, that I was always like, okay, this is great, good, fine that they did this and stuff, but I'm all into the Universal stuff. But now that I've watched so much of the Universal, and now years later, it's like, you know what, I want to dip my toe in some of this and see what they came up with. And it really was fascinating because it was like Peter Cushing was Dr. Frankenstein, or whatever, Dr. Frankenstein, for forever, like in every single movie. So it was almost like one long story, like there was the Revenge of Frankenstein's in this collection, and it's like he's being put to death for everything that he's done up to this point, and he ends up faking his death, and then like changing his name and going somewhere else to try to like do this other stuff, and it's like all this is like this big continuity and stuff like that. It's really interesting. But anyhow, the one that I watched was called These Are the Damned, and I believe it's just called, if you look for it on IMDb, I think it's just listed as The Damned. But it was interesting because, like, at the beginning, it's like, okay, what exactly am I watching? It's from 1962, but it's like got a real like late 50s feel with like this British gang of like motorcycle bikers and stuff. They're all wearing their black leather jackets and stuff, and there's like this crazy music playing, and like it seems like they use this one girl who's the sister of the leader of the gang to like kind of flirt with like older gentlemen that might have money, and she kind of leads them to this area, and then the gang jumps them and beats them up and grabs their money, and that's how this whole thing starts. And you're like, okay, I think I know what I'm getting into. And then as it goes, it just gets crazier and crazier because it turns out there's a bunch of children that had been born, like their parents had, or their mothers rather, had been exposed to some sort of strange radiation that they haven't been able to reproduce. But anyhow, these children are radioactive themselves. And so like, you can't be close to them. You can't hang around them. You'll start dying of radiation poisoning. So they're being taught and molded in this underground bunker by the British government because they feel like nuclear war is inevitable. And at some point, there's, you know, this is what the Earth will be like. It will all be radioactive. And they don't suffer under radiation. So they're their only hope to keep, like, kind of like the British Empire, for, you know, to, ongoing. And this whole – that both of those storylines intersect where – the older gentleman, the girl, and the gang leader end up encountering this bunker and encountering these children and stuff, and it's this huge intersection. It went totally like I didn't expect any of that, and I really enjoyed that movie. It was from a couple of weeks ago. I watched it now, but it's still pretty fresh in my mind because it was so unique, so different. I definitely recommend watching that one. These Are the Damned. If you're looking for it on IMDb, look for The Damned. It's from 1962, and it's a Hammer movie.
Now, this is crazy because this collection has none of the Dracula stuff.
No. It's got a Mummy one. It's got a Frankenstein one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then as you go on, you see it's got like the Pirates of Blood River, the Sword of Sherwood Forest.
Forest, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's got the Creatures from the World Forgot. That's like one of the caveman movies. Like with dinosaurs and stuff. It's interesting. Got a wide selection. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I just want to mention that because that one was unusual. It's not what I expected, and it really was enjoyable.
Cool.
Yeah.
I wish there was one of these for that had like the Dracula and then the Mummy, like the more horror genre ones.
Yes. Yeah, I found that there's an
like the corresponding
movie collection,
yeah.
But it's very far. It doesn't have a ton in there.
Yeah, I see the 8 film collection and a couple of others, but this one definitely has a lot.
But it would be nice if they had like the Hammer Frankenstein collection, the Hammer Dracula collection, and just everything that they made. You know, that would be really, really cool.
Yeah. Cool. That's cool. All right. Well, we can wrap this one up. And you can reach us on Twitter at MythMakingETC. That's Chris. Ivy, who's an inker for many comics. Is he an inker?
Doing a great job.
A letter.
Too.
Yeah, I don't know. Your name shows up a lot as I read more comics.
I spell it different.
Yeah. I'm Mike Myers. He doesn't put the E.
Right.
Yeah. I'm Mike Myers Brunch, and Rob is at Rob Krieger, and the website is geekbrunchpodcast.com. This is Retrocast, and you can find us on Facebook at Geek Brunch Podcast. Click the like button, follow all the episode threads there, and check out these Hammer films. These are interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting
to some
of the other
not, genres. I have not seen one of these in this particular collection.
Me neither.
Yeah. I'm very curious about movies that I haven't seen.
Dark House. I've heard of that. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that's actually the next one on my, you know, that's coming up. So I'm going to watch that one next, I think.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, you guys have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Enjoy your day. Enjoy your weekend.
One question for you, Chris. I wanted to ask you. So, like, when you pick something from the library to read, like Vampire Tales, do you follow through and finish it, or do you just stick with the one to read for this episode, or what?
Most of the time, I don't follow through with it. No.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm just curious.
But I always a lot of times if I like it, I think. Oh, I might want to read some more. That was interesting, but a lot of times I don't end up doing it.
All right. Well, you guys take care, and I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Take care, guys. Bye, guys.